The views and opinions expressed in this presentation are those of the producer and those appearing in this show, and do not necessarily represent the views of Dairy Cam, the town of Dairy, or any of its staff or affiliates.
I can't help but feel good. I can't help but feel fine. Everything is in its place, and all of it is mine.
Ooh, I can't help but smile.
Hi, my name is Gail Nastasia. I am the author of The Fruit You'll Never See, a memoir about overcoming shame, and I'm here with my guest co-host, Tony O'Shaughnessy. We want to welcome you to our show, All Things Recovery, where we discuss all topics regarding mental health, substance abuse, treatment options, and the mental health system. We cover these topics by inviting guests from all facets of recovery, treatment, enforcement, and policy. The door is wide open, and we want to be a resource. We take topic suggestions and welcome feedback. This show is dedicated to recovery warrior Craig Barnaby, who dedicated his life to the well-being of others. Today, we have Jasmine Grace, founding director of Jasmine Grace Outreach and author of The Diary of Jasmine Grace, Trafficked, Recovered, Redeemed. Before we have you introduce yourself, I just want Tony to introduce what his title is, since I couldn't repeat it if I tried. So tell us what your title is, Tony.
Hi, my name's Tony O'Shaughnessy. I'm Senior Business Development Representative at Granite Recovery Centers.
Thank you, Tony. And Tom couldn't be with us today, unfortunately, but he will be back in a couple of weeks. So Jasmine, tell us about yourself. I mean, we just met recently, and you have apparently taken the world by storm in that area of what you do. I mean, everybody knows your name. It's a popular name. So tell me, how did you get into that?
Yeah. So today, I mean, I'm a homeschool mom, right? I have a bunch of kids. I drive a minivan. I live in New Hampshire. I totally make fun of myself because I'm from Massachusetts, and we moved here, my husband and I, with our kids about 7 years ago. And about 10 to 12 years ago, I started a ministry, just wanting to go back out on the streets and help women who have survived exploitation, prostitution, trafficking, and addiction, just like myself. Realized that I was a survivor of the commercial sex trade, that I was a survivor of trafficking, and I just felt compelled to go out and reach those women and let them know there was a better way. And I did not mean for it to turn into a big thing.
It's a big thing. So tell us about that. Like, how did you get to be in that position?
In the first place, so I was trafficked, and I didn't realize that my trafficker did a really good job at manipulation and coercion, brainwashing me into becoming a prostitute. Traffickers' number one goal is to make the victim believe they chose that life. And then you base our culture and society and the entertainment business on top of our early childhood experiences, and it's very easy to believe that you ended up choosing it, even though no little girl dreams of becoming a prostitute.
Right? I know.
Yeah,
we've had that.
There's nothing on our list that we want to do, even if we grow up in that type of environment. Something just isn't sitting right. And for me, you know, growing up in a home with two parents who are still married to this day, but a lot of dysfunction, mm-hmm. right? My mom suffers with mental illness, and so much so that she could really barely take care of me in that sense of providing that care and nurture that we all need, because she couldn't take care of herself, really. And my dad worked a lot to provide for the family, so he was always gone. Mm-hmm. And I had a big extended family on my mom's side that we saw the most often, and there was a lot of addiction and criminal behavior and dysfunction, and I just kind of had no shot, right? Kind of just grew up that way. Big Italian Catholic family, and it was a good time, but really had no shot. And grew up on my own, and back then, you grew up on the streets, right? No one was really paying attention. Today, our kids are growing up on the internet, right? And there's even books written about it, like, who's raising the kids?
Right.
The internet, which is even kind of more scary, because we know that's the number one place today where trafficking occurs, right? Where traffickers find their victims.
More accessible.
More accessible online, very easy.
Right.
And so just going through vocational high school, becoming a hairdresser, having dreams and goals and wanting to do stuff with my life, but also having a piece of me that was very vulnerable and naive and broken, right? I had spelled love, S-E-X. I didn't know that's not what I was mm-hmm. supposed to do, and if I wasn't giving it, they were taking it, so experiencing.
I think a lot of us have that same.
Experiencing sexual violence as a young girl and just having that hole, right, in my heart and trying to fill it, as we know we say in recovery, people, places, and things. Mm-hmm. and a trafficker came along but posed as the boyfriend.
Now, were you already using at that time?
No, I was partying with my friends, drinking, you know, here and there, being a typical teenager without supervision, essentially. And I was at a local nightclub. If you're from Massachusetts, you remember the Palace?
Vaguely, but okay. I do.
And I was partying there all the time, underage, where I shouldn't have been. And he met me there, and he knew some friends, right? So he wasn't a complete stranger. And we exchanged phone numbers and got together, and when he showed up for the date in a champagne-colored Mercedes-Benz and a lot of cash and bling and dressed nice and handsome. I was impressed, right? I was intrigued. I was just out of high school. I never dated a guy like that. And the red flags were there in the sense of he was probably a drug dealer. But again, the way I was raised and our culture and society, that's normalized or glamorized and fine. And I just fell into a relationship with him. And during this period of like 3 to 6 months, he groomed me into this position. And he never like would use the words trafficking or even...
Well, of course not.
Yeah. He wouldn't even say like, you're going to be a prostitute. You know, like they normalize it. You know, sex work is always normalized. It's always sold as woman's empowerment. Mm-hmm. I remember mentioned this before with you about Pretty Woman, mm-hmm. right? And the movies that we watched, especially as a kid, like Julia Roberts was empowered.
Like going to save me. Like yeah. It's going to be, yeah.
And Richard Gere never showed up in a Lamborghini or put pearls around my neck the 8 years I was in the commercial sex trade. But that's what's promised. And these young girls today are exposed to this, especially with other apps and websites like Sugaring and OnlyFans. You know, they don't even need a trafficker today. They're like posting ads of themselves on these websites or these apps because the promise.
And then in the sugar babies, they think that they're like I when I was young that I thought I had something they wanted, mm-hmm. so I was in control. Like I had that.
Right, but it's actually the exact opposite. And when you get involved in the commercial sex trade, you don't realize the deep, deep soul damage that it does. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that you lay your head on the pillow at night and feel good about yourself. You just don't. But that money gives you a false sense of power and a false sense of security, and you just try to wash all that away with those materialistic stuff, which, again, leaves you empty, right? Because it never really ultimately fulfills. So my trafficker groomed me, got me into this position and promised family, business, all the things. And before I know it, a lot of other circumstances happened, but I was sent to a massage parlor in Hartford, Connecticut. That was a brothel, essentially, and had been in business very long, 30, 20 years in Hartford. People have no idea what's going on behind closed doors. And he was trying to break me down mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, as much as he could. And he sent me there on purpose. Instead of sending me to the street, like the track in downtown Boston, because they were kind of cleaning up the streets at that time. Mm-hmm. So this indoor place was hardcore, and he sent me there deliberately. And it worked. You know, I was very, very much broken. Had to stay there and work from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. a few days in a row. And when he came to pick me up after a few days of being there, I was so disgusted. I was so ashamed. Mm-hmm. I was so broken, for lack of better words. And he just put out the hand, and that meant a hand.
And that shame is cyclical. Like, if I feel bad, I'm going to do things to feel better, and then those things are going to block me off, and then I'm going to feel bad. And then it's like that gold commercial when I do cocaine so I can keep going, so I can make more money, so I can get more coca, that whole,
it's a cycle. Right? Yeah, exactly. And felt tons of shame, and no self-worth, and disgusting, and how is he going to love me if I'm having sex with strangers? You know, all this confusion. Confusion is another tool, shame and confusion, big time. And he put out the hand, and I knew that meant to hand over the money. And I had a lot of thoughts in my mind, but I didn't have the courage to speak that. And he said, is there going to be a problem? And I said, no. And I handed it over. So I feel like, you know, in that power and control, that dynamic there. And went back to my family's house, went back to college, was working at a hair salon, and every few days I'd disappear and get sent to Connecticut. And no one was asking because I was 19. My parents thought I was just a 19-year-old doing whatever. And I couldn't stand it anymore because I was lying, living this double life, and I started to change my mind, and that's when he used violence as a way to keep me under his control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he always had a gun on him or in the glove box, and put his hands on me. I was never in a domestic violence relationship before. My father never even raised his voice. He's not that type of guy. And when someone puts their hands on you, everything changes.
Now, were you using?
Clean. The entire time.
Really?
In Trafica, 5 years, completely sober.
And but you're sober now, clean.
Yeah.
So you did pick up at some point.
So once I exited after those 5 years of being under his control, or escaped, for a better word, I guess, once I was right. able to get out, I tried to do life on life's terms. I tried to get a normal job, 9 to 5, as a secretary. Can you imagine? Like, I was in the commercial sex trade under his control, mind control. It's like being in a cult, right? It's
right.
deep mental and emotional bondage. For me, I was never handcuffed to a radiator. Like, some women are, right? They are stuffed in storage crates, handcuffed, like, legit.
Yeah, I wasn't either. I mean, I get it.
It's the mental right. and emotional bondage. And so you take that and you plop me into normal society, and I tried to function, but I couldn't. I was like a fish out of water, and I started hanging out with new friends, and I had a big empty apartment, and they'd all come over and enter in OxyContin. Mm-hmm. And that was just a whole lot better than therapy, because I could just be sedated. And no one, I don't think, sets out to be an addict, right? But I just want the pain to go away, right? Can someone please just make the pain go away?
I just want to feel better.
And that's what it was doing. It was just erasing the pain. But now it pushed me back into the life of prostitution, not with a pimp, but with a growing drug habit. And of course, life would unravel, right? Because you can't get high and live a normal, productive life. And I was a prostitute, and that, you know, comes with more trauma and shame and abuse. And before I know it, I'm a heroin addict. And I'm sleeping on park benches, and I'm homeless, and I'm doing all the things that active addiction comes with. And then I finally got clean and sober after many, many attempts in treatment, in and out of detoxes, trying to do the spin dry.
Yeah, I've had a couple of goes, I think. Tony, it's the last time they hit a few. Yeah,
trying to not surrender, right, fully, because that's the scary part, and that's
trying to find an easier, softer way. Like, there's got to be a better way than actually stopping.
Dude, I mean, that doesn't work.
Right.
I've tried everything, and once I finally got clean and sober for the last time, I was tired. I was beat up. You know, just like all of us, finally come into recovery, pretty beat up, and a really compassionate. Addiction counselor at a treatment center I was at looked at me in the eyes with compassion, and he had caught wind of my story. I wasn't sharing it like I do today, but somehow the prostitution, and he just said, "You don't have to ever sell yourself again." And I thought,
"Oh my God, I don't ever have to sell myself again."
That's a thing. I don't, right? Because I had been ingrained. Think about it; it'd been almost like a decade by this point, and that become your identity, right? At the core of it, right? Again, we're talking about shame, confusion, and then it's identity. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm a no good, dirty prostitute for the rest of my life. No one's gonna love me, you know. And the hopelessness sets in, and et cetera. And when he said that, I knew that I had to, if I was getting clean, I couldn't prostitute. Like, it just now at this point went hand in hand.
Right.
So everything got put down. I turned over my life. I surrendered, started doing the 12 steps, AA, NA. And then I found a Christian church. A girl from AA took me to church, and she said, "Come, you'll love this. It's not like church." And I said, "Okay, I'll go." Because I wanted to know who the higher power was. And sure enough, I thought she, like, told the pastor my life story. You know, I don't know if that's ever happened.
Oh, yeah, many times. Yeah.
Yep.
And of course she didn't, but he said everything like that right to my heart. And yeah, long story, gave my life to the Lord, found Jesus as my answer, and found the Christian church as a safe, supportive place. They didn't judge me. They loved me. The men were appropriate. Like, I just was able to rebuild my life, like, and have trust in humanity again. And still didn't know I was a survivor of the sex trade until 5 years into recovery. But that's a whole nother second.
Well, tell us about that. So then, now you're clean, you're sober, you're on a spiritual journey.
Yep.
You've found a church that you connect with.
And people, good community.
Yeah.
I got pregnant at 6 months clean, right? Because I found Jesus in recovery. I thought everyone would want to.
So that was your first. You said that you have five.
At this point, yeah. So yes, so that was my first, because I thought like everyone would want to get in recovery.
It's so exciting. I mean, I think most people do, but the work, like we were talking about earlier, you know, like, do we really have to go through all that?
Right.
You know, isn't there an easier way?
Right. And unfortunately, he was not interested, and I got pregnant, and I thought, well, that's not how you convert them either. And then also, as on reflection, like, I was still looking to men, right, for validation and et cetera. But it's early recovery. You do stupid things. You make mistakes till you learn and things. And again, my community, my church, they were supportive. I thought they were going to, like, stone me. I'm the pregnant woman out of wedlock. You know, all these things. No, like, that just wasn't the case. I had my son. He's 15 now. managed to did good, kept him alive, did well. He's like, I don't think he'll need the most therapy, but he's great. He's a football player. He actually lives in New Hampshire, close by here, with his dad. And I got married when he was probably one to a guy I met in church with a big trauma and addiction history as well. And
is he in recovery also?
My husband, yes. And we just, I always say, I laugh and say, if you want a good way of making your trauma expose yourself, get married. Or get into an intimate relationship.
People are mirrors, right?
Oh, yeah. And all we did was trigger each other. And we could not do this. And we had our daughter, and we separated. And within that separation, I sought deeper healing. I was always in substance use counseling. But then when my faith started to grow, I switched to Christian counseling because my faith was growing, and that woman couldn't come alongside with my faith and that. So I was in Christian counseling for 7 years, like legit straight. I knew I needed help. I'm a mess. My marriage is obviously a mess. I don't know why. Couldn't figure out the details. I can't do this intimacy. Couldn't trust. I couldn't be vulnerable. None of that.
Right.
I just didn't understand why. And through my faith, the healing came. It's a whole long story. It's in my book. It's called The Diary of Jasmine Grace. That's a whole other
I do have portion. A copy of that.
Yeah, thanks. And the healing came, and someone told me that I was a survivor of trafficking. And that's when everything changed. So
Jasmine and I met. We did a show together not too long ago about sex trafficking. And I know you haven't read my book, but I didn't know I was trafficked. I was young. I was very young. I was, you know, like 12 to 15-ish, 16. So I recently learned. So you say you didn't know this until, you know, you were 5 years sober or whatever. I'm 21 years sober. And this is just this year, like since the book came out, because, you know, people have said it to me. I didn't come to that conclusion on my own because I thought, you know, being in my own mind, that I was in control, that I was smart enough to know, you know, what I was doing, that I was making those decisions. I didn't get the grooming process. I didn't realize. I thought I was too smart for that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, because in your own mind, you see things a certain way.
Right.
So, anyway.
Isn't
that
it
was
mind-blowing?
It's mind-blowing.
And puts a lot of pieces together and makes sense and, yeah.
Yeah.
When you think about the whole story.
I think that's really, so I work in the substance use disorder and mental health treatment industry, residential mostly, really consistent with a lot of the women and men that we see day to day. A lot of them have been trafficked. They're survivors of human trafficking, but they don't even know it, which is interesting. And then I wanted to ask, so I've been working with this one woman for about 9 years. She and her brother has been trying to get her into treatment. I've been trying to get her into treatment on and off for 9 years, text messaging and phone calls. We can't get her into treatment. She continues to be trafficked. And I guess I heard you say that you finally left. What is it? I know that she has a trafficker. Even if she went into a treatment setting, I think he would follow her and take her out. But, like, why is it that, what's preventing her from getting into treatment? That's what I don't understand.
Those trauma bonds, the identity. I don't know what her early childhood experience has been, but it all links to that identity, right? Mm-hmm. She does believe at this point this is her life, and the hopelessness and the shame and her experiences make it reality.
Yep.
Because you engage in the commercial sex and you feel disgusting, mm-hmm. right? And you have to lie to every buyer you're with because you have to have a different story, mm-hmm. usually, right? Because you have to sell the fantasy. They're paying for a service, so you have to be the pot. And it just does so much damage each time. And God only knows, you know, how long she's been with this trafficker or what kind of hold he has on her. The trauma bond is all I can really say.
So it has to be a bond that's stronger than that. Or there has to be something that's stronger than that. And I think, you know, we're all in recovery, like that idea of a higher power, that's why that is so important, because there has to be something that's bigger than...
glimmer of hope, really.
Something bigger. Right?
Getting from someone like you would probably be helpful.
Right, and that's why we do the work we do today, right?
So which is a great segue.
Yeah. So we go into treatment centers. We started doing these bags of hope, and I'd give out bags filled with toiletries to women all over Massachusetts. I'm from the North Shore, so I'd go to Lynn especially because I could find them easy on the street. and give some resources and let them know there's a better way. Then people started donating, giving money and all the things. So we turned it into a real ministry. We called it Bags of Hope. Yeah, we called it Bags of Hope. And then I started running groups in the halfway houses to help women self-identify. That was the key. So I'm like, all these women are in halfway houses. They don't know they're survivors. This has been a way of life for them all these years. Let me go in and start a group. So we use Seeking Safety, which is a curriculum.
Of course.
And in that, in the third group, we close the group so we can connect and make it safe and no other women can come in. So I'm bonding, I'm creating the safe space. And I share my story. And all of a sudden, the light bulbs start going on. And they're like, huh, wait, he's not my boyfriend? You mean I'm being exploited? You mean I'm prostituting myself to support my drug habit? And that's like a thing? Like, that's called exploitation? Right. And my drug dealer is exploiting me? And that guy's not my boyfriend. He's my pimp? You know, and all the light bulbs go on. And then we help them exit, and we walk alongside. And so for many years, we sent them to safe houses across the country because there was a lack of them, as you know, like in New England. And we'd fill in those gaps. We'd walk hand in hand. We'd pay for the bus, the airfare, whatever it was. And then just this past year, we were able to open up our own home in New Hampshire, and we call it Living Hope Farms. And it's been open probably like 8 months now or so. And the women can come and stay free of charge up to a year as they work on their healing.
And that's all by donation?
Yes, all privately funded. No state or federal funding.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And these safe homes, obviously, they're at undisclosed locations. The women are safe.
Yep. It's in the sticks.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, we like it like that. You know, when the women come, they can't believe it. It's a little overwhelming sometimes, too. Like, where are you taking me?
How do you ensure that they keep it that way?
Oh, well, we're learning.
That's part of the challenge. Because
you need to come pick me up right now because I'm, you know, like,
talk about the trauma bonds. We've had a woman call her trafficker from the house phone. Mm-hmm. So we've learned that lesson. We do have like a cell phone policy where they surrender their phone. We only had a policy of 3 months in the beginning. And we noticed right when we gave the phone back at 3 months, took them right out. They were on OnlyFans. They were back on Instagram. They were connecting with all the inappropriate men. And they went out.
Right.
So we changed it to 9 months. Okay, this girl had no problem surrendering her phone because she had another one tucked that we didn't notice. She was using that. You know, so you learn, and we are learning.
I can see that would be a challenge.
It is. And, you know, and this, again, these women talk about that trauma and that bonding and that identity where they can see, I want a new way of life. This is hard. This is tiring. But I really can't fully surrender because recovery is hard, right? Do you guys remember, like, in the beginning, like, you did it kind of with gritted teeth?
Well,
like, you're not excited.
And the shame, though, because yes, I mean, I started coming to AA when I was 15.
Right.
So I kind of grew up in AA. So, I mean, both. You know, I had that, they say, the head full of AA, the belly full of beer. So it's like that. I know that there's a better way of life, but it's not for me. Like, I'm that bad. You know, like, there's something inherently wrong with me that maybe not isn't wrong with those other people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is a big problem for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And it's a process. It is a process. So a lot of them that have come and then left still call us. We still help them get into other treatment centers and get them clean, get them off the street. You know, it is a process. I left my trafficker. I can't even count how many times during those 5 years. But I had parents to go back home to, and I wasn't addicted.
Right.
So I just went home to my parents, and I stayed there for a couple, maybe weeks, days, until he came back and manipulated and coerced and cried, and I'd go back.
But now if you're, you know, physiologically dependent on any opiate and you don't have any cash to support your addiction, there's a quick way to make cash, go back to your abuser, to your trafficker. Now you have income and you're not sick anymore because we know when we're sick, we'll do just about anything to feel okay.
Mm-hmm. Desperate times.
Yeah.
I do, what I've realized throughout the course of publishing my book is that shame was my first thing. You know, that was the first thing that kept me out there. I mean, well, even when I was, you know, a young child, that was my first thing, and it was my last thing to overcome. Mm. So you have 5 kids. They must know your story,
yep,
right? And that means that you've overcome that shame, too.
Totally. totally have been able to overcome that shame. And through overcoming the shame, been able to forgive.
Right.
And I think the forgiveness has a lot to do with healing from trauma as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a process, and it's a lifelong process. And my faith plays a huge role, right, in my healing, in my recovery, in my ability to do all these things, and to raise my children. I'm probably a little overbearing. All right, let's admit it. I do have a 12-year-old daughter. Like, she ain't going nowhere without, you know. And I want to put her in plastic bubble wrap, and she's beautiful. And it's hard. It's really hard. The world is an ugly, scary place.
So now, as far as treatment, obviously you're in the treatment field too. How do you help people to overcome that shame? Because I think that keeps people out there.
My story, right, as transparent and authentic as possible, and then all of a sudden, they don't feel so alone. Mm-hmm. They don't feel so crazy. And then we just walk alongside and we go through a healing process. You know, we run different kind of groups. We bring them to faith if that's what they want to do. Just really
get them into treatment, get them stabilized, outpatient therapist, trauma mm-hmm. reduction therapy. I'm sure there's,
you know. And just love them.
Yeah, love them.
At the house.
Right.
Are all those things available?
Yeah.
And how? I mean, do people come to you?
Yeah, so we have a four-phase program. So in those first, that first phase for 3 months, they're really in the house, right? And we're working on things, getting their social security card, their birth certificate, right? Starting from scratch. Stabilizing their medication. They need 30 days sober, first of all, to come in, because I don't have a clinical team there working. Mm-hmm. So we need them to have that stability. And then we just work on building those blocks and putting it all together. And as they go through, they're just healing more, getting more stability, gaining more independence, working on their identity, and they're able to flourish.
So what is the process like for somebody to get into the house?
To be referred. So usually they can self-refer by just emailing or calling us, and we have like an application process. Or a lot of treatment centers are getting to know us, especially in New Hampshire, so they're referring.
Nobody knows you.
Yeah, so they're referring the women. And I'd love to come and speak.
Love to have you.
We've ran groups here in Nashua at the Process Recovery Center, which is my favorite. I just love it. And I love sharing and just coming alongside and helping these women know that, like, it's a thing and you're not alone and there's a better way.
Yeah, one of the things that makes me think about is I grew up feeling like, you know, there were two kinds of people, and I was the throwaway kind. Mm. And I know that a lot of people feel that way, in that, you know, people, addiction, that yep. any kind of low bottom yep. situation. So, I mean, that's the process, right? Is to come overcome that feeling, that belief. Right.
And it's planting seeds of hope, and as long as there's breath there in those lungs, like, there's a chance, you know, they can get it. And I know for myself how many times, in and out, in and out, in and out. It just takes time. Mm-hmm. And we're all different service providers, are just planting those seeds, right? Just planting the seeds is a better way.
So tell us, if somebody wanted to, say they're watching the show now and they wait a minute, this is me, this mm-hmm. is my situation, what would they do in terms of reaching out to you?
They could go on our website. I'll tell them. You can visit us on our website. It's jasminegrace.org. You can email us through that website. Our phone number is on there. You can give us a call. There's a referral form on there as well. Any way that we can help walk through the process, get you into treatment, whether that's a hospital or a detox, and walk through the whole process with you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Jasmine.
We could go on forever. I know.
Oh, yeah.
We got a lot to say. Please continue to tune in. We're here to provide resources. If you are in crisis, dial 911. To seek services, call 211. And if you're suicidal, call 988, the Suicide and Crisis Line. Help and support are available. You just have to ask for it. Please don't do this recovery thing alone. You don't have to.
Opinions expressed in this presentation are those of the producer and those appearing in this show, and do not necessarily represent the views of DairyCam, the town of Derry, or any of its staff or affiliates.